Now you can listen to WNYC on your schedule. Download the WNYC app with the Discover feature. Pick a few topics and how long you want to listen. You'll get a custom playlist on your phone. It's radio on your own time at WNYC.org/mobile.
When the BP oil spill hit the Gulf of Mexico, both British Petroleum and the U.S. Coast Guard guessed that the amount of oil leaking into the water was probably impossible to measure, although they estimated it was around 1,000 barrels a day. They soon found that estimate and the idea of not being able to measure the spill was wrong. Responsible for changing their minds was John Amos, whose organization SkyTruth uses public domain satellite images to track developments that impact the environment. And I'm very pleased to welcome John Amos to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Happy to be here today.
So you're using public domain technology to monitor projects that impact the environment. Can anyone do that?
Yeah, well, in a sense, yes. We don't have any secret sauce. We don't have any secret sources of data or spy imagery or anything that that anybody else wouldn't have access to. So in the broadest terms, yeah, anybody can do a little sky truthing of their own. You know, what we do have is we have some expertise that comes from a couple of decades of experience looking at thousands of satellite images and analyzing the stories that they tell. And that's something that's a little special about us.
You mentioned that you have been doing this for a while. You're using data that's been accumulated over the past 40 years.
That's right. You know, one of the fantastic stories of, I think of NASA and the space age in general that people may not fully appreciate is, you know, we've been looking hard at planet Earth for at least 40 years now, and there's this incredible archive of satellite pictures of the planet that has accumulated over that time. So not only can we use this technology to see what's happening now anywhere on the planet, we can use it to do some time travel and go back in time and look at how things used to be. And sometimes the comparison is very striking.
Well, new satellites are going up all the time, and I assume that the technology has improved a lot over the last four decades. So can you, to some degree, isn't it comparing apples and oranges?
Well, one of the wonderful things about the Landsat satellite program is, although they have improved it, they've made a conscious decision to keep the images very comparable with images collected in previous years. And so there's a wonderful tool that was just released a couple months ago called TimeLapse. This was a project of Time Magazine and I believe Google and NASA, where you can go see an animated time travel movie for any place on planet Earth, and you can observe 40 years of change in a couple of minutes right in front of your very eyes.
From the images sent down by NASA satellites?
That's right, the Landsat satellites specifically. But there are other satellites operating up there, launched by various government agencies, launched by private commercial businesses that, you know, make a living selling the data. And some of those images are much higher resolution than the Landsat imagery. In fact, anyone with a credit card now can buy a satellite image from anywhere on the planet that has a resolution of about 40 centimeters. So that's not quite good enough to see an individual person. We don't have that kind of ability. But it is good enough to see if there's a car parked in front of your house and, you know, what color that car is.
Can we do this by using Google Earth?
Well, Google Earth is a fantastic tool. When they came out, they were a real landmark in the democratization of this satellite imagery and this unique source of data. And much of the imagery for the United States that's in Google Earth is very high resolution, 1 meter detail or better. So, you know, that's about 3 feet. And certainly anybody who's looked up their home in Google Earth probably has a good appreciation for the level of detail that is and is not available through that system. But, you know, there's been a lot of talk and concern, and rightly so, about government spying on people. And now I've heard some reactions from people saying, well, now the environmentalists are spying on people. And I have to say, you know, we don't really have the capabilities that people seem to think that we do. And one of the things about Google Earth is the imagery that's in it isn't stuff that was taken today or stuff that was taken yesterday. In most cases, you're looking at images that were taken 1 or 2 or 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they routinely update that, but it's not really an effective tool for spying on people. But it's a very good tool for tracking changes in the environment that are unfolding through time in your neighborhood or anywhere else.
But what do you do with the images once you have them?
Well, so we do a number of things. We work on some specific projects. For example, tracking the landscape and habitat impacts of oil and gas drilling and fracking. And we started doing that work really when SkyTruth began in 2001, looking at the drilling boom that was taking place on public lands out in the Rocky Mountain West, out in Wyoming and Colorado and Utah and Montana, where a lot of drilling was happening that folks in the East weren't really paying much attention to. Now, as that drilling and fracking technology has moved to the East, to the Mid-Atlantic with the Marcellus Shale and the Utica Shale drilling, a lot more people are starting to pay attention to that. So we take those images, we bring them into a digital mapping system, and we can actually trace and map and quantify direct changes to the land surface from all of the construction activity that accompanies drilling.
Have you seen anything that surprised you, developments in a place that you hadn't expected?
Well, you know, one of the reasons I started SkyTruth, I used to use this technology for oil and gas exploration. In fact, I spent 10 years doing exploration studies for oil and gas and mining companies using this remote sensing technology as an exploration tool. But increasingly, as I did that work, I saw that these images also told some interesting and sometimes very surprising environmental stories. And one of the images that really made me decide I needed to use this technology for environmental good was an image I got from an area of western Wyoming that showed the gas drilling that was happening there. And it showed that this drilling was not taking place using the new environmentally lower impact drilling technology that was being touted by the industry. It was essentially being done in a very old-fashioned, intensive, highly disruptive, kind of old-school manner. And this was happening on public land, where I felt, if anything, we should be holding companies engaged in industrial activity to a higher standard. And yet I was seeing the opposite. I was seeing them allowed to drill in a way that people wouldn't allow on their private property. And so that really surprised me. As a guy who worked for the industry, I thought that they were using this environmentally friendly drilling technology everywhere. And lo and behold, I could see with my own eyes that was not the case.
I'm talking with John Amos, whose organization, SkyTruth, uses public domain satellite images to track developments that have an impact on the environment. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, you're a geologist by trade, by training, so you can see things perhaps that I wouldn't notice, right?
Well, you in some cases, that is true. You know, one of the areas where we do a lot of work is actually using a very special kind of satellite imagery, radar satellite images, to detect oil pollution at sea. This was a very important technology for tracking the size and the movement of the oil slicks in the Gulf of Mexico during the BP oil spill in 2010.
Well, how do you see an oil slick on a satellite picture?
Well, there are a couple different ways to do it. With the radar satellite imagery, radar is a tool that's very sensitive to the roughness of surfaces. That may seem surprising, but essentially the more uneven and bumpy and rough a surface is, the more strongly it reflects radar energy back up to the satellite, and the brighter it looks. So a slick is a big smooth patch out in the water. And the smooth patch in the water can be caused by oil floating on the water. It can be caused by heavy rainfall beating the water flat. It can be caused by just very low wind, so the water's very calm. In any of those cases, that flat water shows up very clearly as a black patch on a radar satellite image. Now, the trick is knowing what the cause is of that black patch. Is it oil? Is it low wind? Is it something else? And that's where experience with looking at lots of these images and knowing the causes in specific cases helps us analyze that imagery more effectively.
Didn't the original estimate of the amount of oil to have accumulated in the Gulf after the BP spill, didn't that number come from a blogger using the same public domain NASA images you use? What did you see that that blogger didn't?
Oh, well, so I think it was 5 days into the spill, we actually posted on our blog a calculation of the size of the spill. With help from an oceanographer at Florida State University named Ian McDonald, who spent his career studying oil in the Gulf of Mexico. We used NASA public domain imagery and measured the size of the oil slick and did some very conservative calculations about how thick the oil had to be for us to see it on those satellite images. And our conservative estimate was, on average, the oil slick had to be 1/1,000th of a millimeter thick. And yet we knew that in many places the oil slick was much thicker than that. We all saw those photographs of pelicans covered in this thick, gloppy oil, aerial photographs showing these thick streaks and streamers of oil floating on the water. So our calculation was quite conservative, and yet when we multiplied that thickness across the area, the size of the oil slick that we could see day to day on the imagery, we knew that there was a big mismatch between what we were able to observe directly and what we were being told by BP and the federal government.
So it was a lot more than 1,000 barrels a day.
Yeah, our first calculation, conservative calculation, came up with 5,000 barrels per day. And then later that same day, there was a BP person talking to the media who actually provided some specific information about the thickness of the oil slick that bumped our estimate up to 20,000 barrels a day. And a few days later, our colleague Ian McDonald came up with a revised estimate of 25,000 barrels per day. Ultimately, what we like to think our contribution was it spurred the federal government to actually assemble a team of scientists to come up with ways of estimating the oil spill size independent from what BP was telling them.
And the White House called you after you posted your findings.
You know, that's what my colleague Paul Woods reminds me that happened. I have to tell you, things were quite a blur during that time period. I'm told that we did get a call from White House staff wanting to know how we were calculating this and why our number was so much larger than what BP and the Coast Guard were saying. So, you know, one thing we try to do is be perfectly transparent about the data we're using, where it's coming from, what we're doing to it, and any assumptions that we make. And we blogged that throughout the spill so that anybody could kick the tires on our methodology and criticize it and examine our assumptions and come up with their own approach. But we found very little criticism of the method we were using.
Has your research had an impact on policy and the cleanup in the Gulf since, or on BP's fine?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question at this point. I should say the multi-billion-dollar question at this point that is about to be taken up by the judge in New Orleans who is presiding over the BP trial. So phase one of the trial was, did BP act recklessly? Phase two of the trial, about to start in mid-September, I believe, is how big was the spill? And this is critically important because the size of the civil fine that BP and their partners will have to pay is directly tied to the judge's final decision on how many gallons of oil went into the Gulf during that spill. And then so if the original 1,000 barrel a day number had been left unchallenged, the federal government never would have assembled, perhaps never would have assembled their team of scientists who finally estimated that the number was actually not 1,000 barrels a day, but 60,000 barrels a day, 60 times larger than what BP was saying. And that could translate into a difference in fine money of, I think I calculated $17 billion. What's important about that is Congress passed legislation that would allocate 80% of that money to fund restoration projects in the Gulf region to help restore some of this damage that occurred. So I think we may hopefully have played a part in really ensuring that much more restoration work will be possible.
John, just one more thing. Last week it was revealed that the company that produced the environmental impact study for the Keystone XL pipeline project failed to disclose the fact that it had once worked with the company building the pipeline. Now, you can't do anything until a pipeline is built, but will you be following Keystone XL?
You know, we already have. We've done a little bit of work on that because you may remember early on there was controversy about the route of the pipeline through Nebraska, through some ecologically sensitive areas and over an economically important groundwater source for the region. So we did a little work showing the alternative route that they came up with. But more important to us, actually, than the pipeline itself is the activity that it is supporting. So we've done quite a lot of work looking at the vast tar sands mining and extraction operation up in Canada. And if this is something people haven't seen, I really encourage them to go to our site and take a look. This is Canada's equivalent of our mountaintop removal mining for coal. It is just laying waste to a vast area. And I think more than anything, it's a clear indication of how increasingly desperate we're getting to maintain our current addiction, as President Bush so aptly put it, to fossil fuels.
And John, how do people get access to your site?
Well, they can go to skytruth.org and look at the things that we do. They can email us at info@skytruth.org if they have specific questions. And we've got a volunteer image analysis project that's very successful right now called Frack Finder. that we encourage people to participate in to try their hand at a little sky truthing.
John Amos is president of Sky Truth, which uses public domain satellite images to track developments that can have an impact on the environment. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks, Leonard.